Sponsoring this new fertility series is Let's Get Checked. They offer home testing kits for sexual health, men's health, and women's health. A kit gets sent discreetly to your place. You collect a sample and send it back. It was really easy to get the results. I got an email notifying me it was ready, and I popped on the website to read my results. I did their female fertility test to help me understand my hormonal health. For 20% off your own kits, use code DNA today at checkout on their website, letsgetchecked.com. Again, that's letsgetchecked.com with code DNA today for 20% off your kits.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. On this show, I explore genetics' impact on our health through conversations with leaders in genetics. These are genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, patient advocates, many more. This episode is kicking off a series about infertility. The launch of the series is coinciding with Infertility Awareness Week, which is April 19th to 25th of 2020. Over the next few episodes of DNA Today, I'm really excited to bring you interviews with experts in fertility. These include genetic counselors, a couple who went through IVF, even filmmakers who produced a science fiction movie about fertility. Currently, 7.3 million Americans face infertility, and I wanted to bring awareness to this, but also education by having these conversations to learn about the science and genetic side, as I'm always interested in that, but also hearing the patient side and hearing how infertility has impacted people's lives and hearing their perspective. So there's so many exciting guests to be looking forward to in the next few episodes of DNA Today. My guest to launch the series is Lauren Isley, who is a genetic counselor that specializes in fertility and assisted reproductive technologies, also known as ART for short. She's a clinical science liaison at California Cryobank Life Sciences, which is a company that provides reproductive tissue and donor gamete services, as well as newborn stem cell storage. Lauren is the chair-elect of the Genetic Counseling Professional Group of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine and former chair of the ART Infertility Special Interest Group of the National Society of Genetic Counselors. Lauren has a bachelor's degree in biology from the University of Missouri. She went on to earn her master's of science in genetic counseling from Wayne State University.
Thank you so much, Lauren, for joining me on this episode. Really excited to have you on as the genetic counseling perspective and talking about all of these types of technologies today.
Sure, Kira. Thanks for having me.
So we can begin by exploring what are the different roles that genetic counselors play in fertility clinic or in the ART setting?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So there are a lot of different roles that genetic counselors can play in the fertility clinic. Some fertility clinics directly employ genetic counselors. So the genetic counselor is actually there on staff and will be there as a resource to help facilitate any genetic testing that might be needed as it pertains to the patient's infertility evaluation. So that might be a karyotype to look for chromosome abnormalities or rearrangements. Could be single gene disorder testing if there's a single gene condition that's suspected that could be contributing to the cause of infertility. They also serve as an educator to patients as it pertains to pre-implantation genetic testing or PGT, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later. And the genetic counselor can also help patients through the process of third-party reproduction, so using an egg or a sperm donor to conceive and making sure that that donor has had the appropriate carrier screening and the appropriate family history risk assessment, and also that the patient or the recipient has also had a family history risk assessment to understand any other potential risks to their offspring or any other genetic testing options that may be available for them in the preconception setting.
So just like so many genetic counselors, you really have to know all of this information in terms of the technologies available, all of the testing that goes with this, but you're talking about this with patients and educating them along with that and all of the psychosocial side of oftentimes when people are, you know, either sitting in your office or you're on the phone with them, they've really been through quite a journey by the time they're getting to you as a genetic counselor that the psychosocial side is so important along with all this technology.
Yes, exactly. And I think that our psychosocial training as genetic counselors really plays a key role in this setting. I think it's important in every setting that genetic counselors work in, but definitely assisted reproduction. There are a lot of psychosocial issues and, a lot that patients are going through when they're going through this process.
And many patients are highly motivated to, they're really wanting to learn a lot of information and they may be educating themselves outside. So those conversations end up becoming very high level in terms of all the technology options that are available. I mean, you mentioned a couple of them. What are like the most common, the ones that you're talking about most with patients?
Yeah, so it kind of depends on the indication that the patient is there for. So the really the main when we're talking about assisted reproductive technology, the vast majority of ART cycles are performed with in vitro fertilization. And so just depending on the patient's scenario, we could be talking about IVF along with pre-implantation genetic testing. We could be talking about IVF with an egg or a sperm donor. And obviously, there are other iterations of genetic testing on embryos as well. But really, the term ART primarily applies to an IVF cycle.
And before trying to conceive, you mentioned carrier screening. It's advantageous for people to have carrier screening before they're headed down, doing an IVF cycle or whatever they're choosing and going for. How does the testing work? Are there certain conditions that are really mainly tested? I mean, there's a lot of different options and panels within all of this. It's hard to pinpoint maybe what is best for a patient and their partner.
Yeah, I really think you hit the nail on the head, Kira. Carrier screening has become such a complex topic with the advent of expanded carrier screening or ECS. So there are many, many different genetic testing labs who offer ECS panels that might be anywhere from 100 to 500 plus diseases. And those panels always seem to be evolving and getting larger. And so it becomes a pain point and a point of confusion for patients who are considering carrier screening. Now, the good thing is, I think carrier screening in the preconception setting, which is obviously in a fertility setting, is extremely important. So when a patient has carrier testing in this setting, it allows them to really maximize their reproductive options moving forward. So, I think as long as patients understand what genes are included on these panels, what the possible test results are, what the next steps are as far as making sure their partner or their gamete donor is tested, I think empowering patients with that knowledge of what their options are moving forward is the most helpful thing to do in that scenario. And if the patient and their partner happens to test positive for the same condition, they obviously, like I mentioned, have all of their reproductive options available, including IVF with pre-implantation genetic testing, use of a gamete donor, adoption. I think even though patients may be getting a lot more information than they bargained for with these large panels of carrier screening, there's a lot that they can do with that information in the fertility setting.
And then one key point that I've learned throughout rotations is that it's important so if one partner is getting carrier screening that they're being tested for the same conditions as the other partner. So if one is positive, make sure that the other one actually was tested for that because there's so many different panels and making sure that that's aligned.
Exactly, Kira. And I think that that concept is relatively straightforward in making sure that patient and partner are tested for the same conditions. In the ART setting, we have to deal with that scenario a little bit differently when an egg or a sperm donor is being used. Because typically, egg and sperm donors are sort of pre-screened, so they're pre-qualified by the gamete donor facility, by a family history risk assessment and genetic testing, and of course the other components that go into qualifying a gamete donor. And so often that genetic testing has already been done on that donor before a patient is choosing that donor to use for their reproductive plans. So having a genetic counselor, I think both in the IVF clinic as well as genetic counselors at gamete facilities can really help to ensure that that recipient and that gamete donor have been tested for the same conditions, or if one person is positive, then the other person has tested negative, and making sure that that recipient understands that concept of residual risk, in understanding that there's always a chance that, you know, there could be an affected offspring despite a negative result. So I think having genetic counselors on both ends to make sure gamete donor and recipient's genetic testing, at least sort of maximizes the amount of information they can get is crucial.
And in terms of donors and the requirements with that, is there aspects of health for that donor or like family history that can prevent someone from becoming a donor or maybe continuing to be a donor? If a lot of this is very new and it's changing, so I'm sure that in the past we didn't have a lot of this, but for now, is there certain things that if someone carries, you know, a certain mutation, or if they have a family history of, say, a lot of cancer that looks like hereditary cancer, can someone be prevented from becoming a donor? Or is it really up to the patients to decide, this is the information, do you want them to be a donor?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Kara. So when I think about evaluating gamete donors as it pertains to health risks and genetic testing, I like to think of it in two separate arms. So I like to think of both the genetic screening side of it, meaning the carrier testing side, as well as the family history risk assessment side. So I think sometimes patients and providers don't understand that a carrier screening panel of 500 diseases isn't going to help with the family history risk assessment on the gamete donor. So to answer your question, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine actually has guidelines about gamete donor qualification and sort of what should go into the genetic evaluation of a gamete donor, and then aspects of a family history or genetic testing results that would generally disqualify a prospective gamete donor from donating at that particular facility. And so when it comes to genetic test results, generally ASRM says that donors should not be affected with a monogenic condition, so should not be affected with an autosomal dominant condition or an X-linked condition. And generally that's because that would pose a significant health risk to the offspring of that donor. There are some other aspects. So we talked about carrier screening earlier. Many of the expanded carrier screening platforms that are available actually do include diseases that being a carrier for those conditions is associated with health risks in that individual. So for example, ataxia telangiectasia is a recessive condition, but someone who is a carrier for a mutation in the ATM gene is at a slightly increased risk for breast cancer. And so it really blurs the line on how we think of autosomal dominant versus autosomal recessive diseases. And so that's something that gamete facilities have to take into consideration when they're performing these large expanded carrier screening panels on their donors, and that, you know, should a positive result for one of these recessive disorders that's associated with health risks exclude the donor from donating?
It's very complicated. There's a lot of pieces that go into becoming a donor. It's not as easy as just showing up.
That's exactly right. And then, you know, most donors, if they don't, they should undergo a family history risk assessment. And that's really best performed by a person trained in medical genetics, such as a genetic counselor. And so that involves typically exactly what you would do in any genetic counseling setting and taking a detailed three-generation pedigree to assess the donor's family history for any health conditions that the donor may be at an increased risk for, or that the donor's offspring may be at an increased risk for. And so there are certain guidelines within ASRM that says if this is present in a donor or the donor's first degree relative, then that generally should exclude the donor from donating. And so it's really important that gamete facilities or gamete donor programs have a trained medical genetics professional on staff, like a genetic counselor, to really evaluate these family histories and tease apart some of these diagnoses to understand if the offspring from that donor could potentially be at risk of inheriting a condition.
So lots of pieces that are focused on there, and it really is extensive to make sure that this donor is appropriate. And so that information, I'm sure, maybe not all of it, but some of it is available to patients looking to use these donor gametes.
Exactly. So any gamete donor program should have a mechanism in which they can distribute that medical information on that gamete donor to the prospective recipients. And then on top of that, we know that medical histories change all the time. So the information that we're getting on a prospective gamete donor is really just a snapshot in that donor's life and that donor's family's life. And so it's really important for gamete donor programs to collect updated medical history on gamete donors, as well as the gamete donor's offspring from the recipients, and make sure that that information is available for everyone.
And another technology that we've talked about a couple times so far, but haven't dived into, is pre-implantation genetic testing, also known as PGT. Can you explain what this testing is, and if it's screening, diagnostic, does it depend? There's a lot of kind of different areas within this.
Yes. So PGT stands for pre-implantation genetic testing, and it's testing that we are performing on embryos before they are implanted into a woman's uterus. There are a couple of different iterations of PGT. So one is PGTA, which stands for pre-implantation genetic testing for aneuploidy, and that's looking for extra or missing chromosomes in the embryo. We have a PGTM, and that stands for PGT for monogenic disorders, and that is screening an embryo for a genetic condition that either both members of the couple are carriers for, or maybe the female is a carrier for an X-linked condition, or one member of the couple is affected with an autosomal dominant condition. And then we also have PGTSR, which stands for PGT for structural rearrangements. And that's sort of like an offshoot of PGTA, in that we're really, we're looking at all of the chromosomes, but we're really honing in on a specific chromosome that's involved in a chromosome rearrangement that one member of the couple carries. So for example, if the male carries a chromosome translocation, PGTSR will sort of hone in on those chromosomes of interest that are involved in the male's translocation and be able to assess, did the embryo inherit an unbalanced form of that chromosome translocation?
And in terms of, that's the three different types, which is really great you outlined it that way, because even for me, when I'm thinking back, I'm like, I know there's different types, which is which. Great explanation. For this type of testing, are, out of those three, are some of them screening and some of them diagnostic, or are they all one way, all the other way?
So that's a really good question. So really, they are all screening tests. And the reason that they're screening tests is because we are taking a very, very, very small amount of DNA, typically from several cells of an embryo. And so when we have such a small amount of DNA to work with, there's a little bit of a larger room for error in being able to accurately assess the chromosomal composition or the single gene disorder. And so we do think of these as screening tests. So as such, there is still a recommendation to follow up with diagnostic testing like a CVS or an amniocentesis once a pregnancy has occurred following IVF with PGT.
And of these PGTs, can you perform, like we talked about the three types, can you do, say, all three types of PGT on one embryo, or do you have to choose one?
Generally, yes. So most labs have what they call amplification techniques. So they receive the embryo biopsy in their lab, which again is just, you know, a subset of cells from the embryo, and they extract out the DNA, and then they're able to amplify that DNA or make a lot more of it. And so generally with that extra DNA that they can make, they are able to run multiple forms of PGT on an embryo sample. So sometimes, for example, if a patient is undergoing IVF for PGTM, let's say they're both carriers of cystic fibrosis, and they really want to have as much information as possible in addition to the cystic fibrosis status of the embryo, they may also opt to undergo PGTA to understand which embryos are euploid with the correct number of chromosomes or aneuploid with the incorrect number of chromosomes. And then that way they can use both cystic fibrosis status and chromosomal status to guide which embryos are best suited for transfer.
And that makes sense. If you're already taking cells and doing this process, that it's probably, in terms of looking at it from a money standpoint, that looking at that extra information is probably worthwhile at that point in going through this testing with all the technology and the effort that's being put into it.
Exactly. I mean, this is both a very big emotional and financial burden on patients when they undergo IVF or any assisted reproductive technology. And so often patients think exactly like that, that, you know, they really want to maximize their chances, and that, you know, if they can undergo this additional chromosome testing to transfer euploid embryos, then it's probably worth their while having gone through this whole process.
And so in terms of other information that PGT can be giving us, a common question from patients, I'm sure, that I've heard even in a prenatal setting is, can it tell the sex of the embryo, and can people choose an embryo based on, say, that alone?
Yeah, PGTA definitely looks at the sex chromosomes of the embryo. And so it is possible to determine whether or not the embryo is male or female. And that's with, of course, the caveat that this is a screening test. So it is possible that there could be a misdiagnosis of sex chromosomes, meaning that a lab could report out the sex chromosomes incorrectly. So patients should definitely understand that. As far as using the sex chromosome information to help guide the embryo transfer, that's really at the discretion of the individual IVF clinic. So, you know, if there are two chromosomally normal female embryos and two chromosomally normal male embryos, then the IVF center may allow the patient to choose which embryo they would like to transfer, because there are multiple embryos that are euploid and suitable for transfer. In situations where a couple may only have two euploid embryos and they're both male embryos, that euploid status would probably take precedent over desiring a child who is female and transferring a chromosomally abnormal embryo. So, really, the bottom line is it's at the discretion of the IVF center, but that information generally is available to patients or can be made available by the laboratory.
And for patients that may have frozen embryos from that a previous cycle that they're looking to use, can PGT be performed on these frozen embryos? And then does it have to be refrozen? How does that process look?
Yeah, generally, if embryos are already frozen, so what happens the majority of the time is the embryos are biopsied by the IVF center, so by the embryologist in the IVF center, and then those embryo biopsies are shipped off to the PGT lab and they're analyzed. And while those embryo biopsies are being shipped off, generally those embryos are then frozen at the IVF clinic. So the majority of the time, if the patient decides they want to pursue PGT along with their IVF cycle, that is done prior to the embryos being frozen. Now, I'm sure there are some scenarios where PGT was not performed and a couple or an individual might have some frozen embryos that they want tested. It usually depends on the quality of the embryo and whether or not the embryologist would feel comfortable thawing, biopsying, and refreezing an embryo. But I have heard of that being performed before.
And so we've been talking a lot about patients that are going through this maybe actively and looking to move along. They're going through an IVF cycle, looking to conceive at that time. But there's also the flip side of people that are not at a point where they're ready to conceive and they're just thinking the future, and they may have heard of egg and sperm freezing. How does this work? And is there like maybe an ideal time to be doing this, or does it really just depend per person?
So this is a really hot topic right now in the fertility industry, in sort of using planned oocyte cryopreservation for future family building purposes. And, you know, I think this is a really great option for individuals in a lot of different scenarios. And there can be a number of reasons why an individual wants to delay childbearing. So obviously that is available for males. If there's any reason why they need to preserve their fertility for future use, it could be active military duty. It could be a cancer diagnosis where they're undergoing chemotherapy, which is gonadotoxic, and may impair their fertility. So generally, we don't think of an issue with or a huge issue with older males trying to conceive. We generally think of that sort of age-related fertility decline as it pertains to females. And so similar to males, females may decide to preserve their fertility if they're undergoing chemotherapy, or even if they just want to delay childbearing. And so many fertility centers do offer this planned oocyte cryopreservation as an option. And in a sense, these women are undergoing an IVF cycle just without that embryo transfer. So it's the same process of stimulating the ovaries to produce a lot of eggs and then undergoing an egg retrieval. And then either those eggs are cryopreserved at that state, or if the female has a male partner or a sperm donor, those eggs can be fertilized into embryos and those embryos can be cryopreserved. So I think it's a very personal decision, but planned oocyte cryopreservation is something that is becoming more popular. I know of some insurance companies that are actually starting to cover it. And I do think it is a great option for individuals who are hoping to delay childbearing. I think one of the big things that we tend to talk about in the industry, though, is that we don't want to overpromise these individuals that this is an absolute slam dunk guarantee that they will be able to have children in the future, that, you know, there's a possibility that these frozen eggs or these frozen embryos may not be successful in a transfer. And so it's important to mitigate those expectations of someone who is looking to preserve their fertility for the future.
And for those patients that may have embryos that are left over from previous cycle and they're finished with childbearing, what are their options of what to do with these leftover embryos?
So many centers do have embryo donation programs where the individual or the couple can actually donate their embryos to another individual or couple who is looking to build their family via donated embryos. And this embryo donation program, I think these programs are starting to grow and they're starting to become more popular because as these cryopreservation techniques have improved significantly over the last 10 or so years, we're seeing a growing number of embryos that are being cryopreserved in these tanks and that may not be needed for family building for the couple or the person that created those embryos. So embryo donation can be an option. The embryos could also be donated for research. And then an individual or couple could also request that those embryos are just destroyed.
So different options there and having the flexibility to be able to make that decision later. I wanted to ask Lauren before we wrap up the episode, kind of a question that is really coming up in the field a lot more with direct consumer testing. It comes up in every area of genetic counseling, but in terms of fertility, how is this impacting gamete donation? Of previously we've said, oh, you can be an anonymous donor, but that concept doesn't seem to exist anymore with these direct consumer testing. We're talking about 23andMe, Ancestry, all of those.
So the field of direct-to-consumer testing has significantly impacted gamete donors. So within these direct-to-consumer tests, 23andMe, Ancestry.com, I like to think of it as getting generally two types of information. So you can receive ancestry and genealogy information, but then some tests also include information about health risks. So as it pertains to ancestry and genealogy, we're seeing more and more situations where individuals learn that they are conceived via gamete donation, learn that they were adopted, and more situations where a gamete donor's anonymity is compromised. So these tests have options that allow someone that takes the test to connect to someone and show what that degree of biological relationship is. And so that's really revealed a lot of biological relationships between offspring and donor. And I think importantly, 10 or more than 10, I'd say 20, 25 years ago, it wasn't as commonplace for individuals using a gamete donor to disclose that to their children. So many offspring who are within that age group, say 20 to 30, actually don't know that they were conceived using a gamete donor. And so many have had to learn that information via these direct-to-consumer tests. As these direct-to-consumer tests relate to health risks, I think when a gamete donor program learns that a gamete donor has taken, or a prospective gamete donor has taken one of these tests, I think it's important for that gamete donor program to make sure that they have all of the information that the donor gained from that test as far as health risks go, and that knowing that any positive genetic test result should really be confirmed in a CLIA-certified laboratory. So gamete programs really should be taking that health risk information from those tests as well and incorporating them into their screening of that prospective gamete donor.
Well, thank you so much for talking about so many topics in fertility. I mean, I could go on about just everything that we've talked about today. It's very, very interesting to dive into all of the bioethics side with this direct consumer test, the technologies, and where we're headed in the future with all of this. It's exciting to see that this is, I mean, genetics is rapidly growing. I probably say that too much on the show, but I think particularly in fertility, it's just been exploding the last, I think, 7 years or so that we were talking before the show. So thank you so much for coming on and being able to kind of indulge me in all of these topics.
You are absolutely welcome, and I couldn't agree with you more. I think the presence of genetics in fertility and assisted reproduction is only growing, and it's growing fast, and it's really important for our profession as genetic counselors to stay involved in this field and make sure we advocate for ourselves in where we can be utilized in this field.
Well said. Thanks so much, Lauren.
Thanks, Kira. I appreciate it.
Next episode, I will be continuing this infertility series. Again, Infertility Awareness Week is April 19th to the 25th in 2020. You can learn more by going to Resolve, the National Infertility Association. They are a nonprofit organization dedicated to ensuring that all people challenged in their family building journey reach resolution through being empowered by knowledge, supported by community, united by advocacy, and inspired to act. Their website is resolve.org. Again, they have a lot of information for Infertility Awareness Week and things to post online, events to be a part of. So resolve.org. I'll link to this in the blog post associated with this episode, available on dnapodcast.com. Actually, all the information for this episode and the 100 plus other episodes of the show are on there. And it also includes my social media on the website. If you want to go straight to it, I'm on Twitter at DNA Podcast, on Instagram at DNA Radio. And as always, if you have questions about this episode, about infertility, you can contact the show by emailing in at info@dnapodcast.com. If it's easier, there's a contact form on the website as well. But if you have questions for myself, Lauren, other genetic counselors that I've had on the show, other guests on the show, you have a comment, you are able to relate to this episode, email in info@dnapodcast.com. We would love to hear from you. Let's Get Checked has stepped up during this pandemic, and I want to thank them for their new two-part test for COVID-19 right now for healthcare workers. They committed to 250,000 tests in the first batch, with the goal to scale to serve over a million in the next few months. As most of you know, Let's Get Checked is sponsoring the series with their at-home testing kits. They have a bunch of fertility tests if you're curious about your fertility status. As I mentioned before, the kit gets sent right to your house, and the sample's a blood sample, but it's from a fingerprint, so you can do it right at home, no need to go into Quest and have your blood drawn. Then you receive your results in just 2 to 5 days, which in my experience is much quicker than most home testing kits where it's like a couple weeks. A couple of hormones that are looked at in their CLIA-certified lab for the female fertility tests includes follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. I found the report on the website super easy to read, but there's also physicians and nurses that you can talk to if you're confused at all in reading this report and understanding really what it means. Try for yourself by going to letsgetchecked.com and use code DNATODAY for 20% off your kits. Again, you can use code DNATODAY for that 20% discount on your kits at letsgetchecked.com. Thanks for listening, and join me next time to learn and discover the new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, they're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.